Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know this is hard to believe. The world has continued to turn this past week. Yeah, really. Stuff goes on in the rest of the world while we have a convention. I know. It should be illegal. This from the Washington Post. For some in the Middle East, the images of Russian tanks rolling into Georgia in defiance of U.S. opposition have revived warm memories of the Cold War. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad flew last week to Moscow, where he endorsed Russia's offensive in Georgia and sought additional Russian weapon system. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's son echoed the delight expressed in much of the Arab news media. What happened in Georgia is a good sign, he says, one that means America is no longer the sole world power setting the rules of the game. In Turkey, an American and European ally that obtains more than two-thirds of its natural gas from Russia, interesting, the reaction was more complex. Turkish Prime Minister has tried to persuade the leaders of Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Russia to put their political differences aside in the interest of keeping oil and gas flowing, like to Turkey. Russian leaders, angry at Turkish military aid to Georgia, which will increase if Georgia goes into the NATO deal, reportedly refused to take the Turkish Prime Minister's calls. Hello? Russia has been paying closer attention to the needs of the United States' least favorite Middle East countries, Syria and Iran. Just an indication that Karen Hughes' job as head of public diplomacy at the State Department, making the Middle East like us more, another mission accomplished. Ladies and gentlemen, for the past 6 years, the Washington Post also reports military relations between the United States and Afghanistan. This is in the shadows of the United States and Iraq still not having concluded that agreement that gives the legal basis, excuse me, for the United States troops to stay in Iraq after the UN mandate expires this December. So what's the legal basis for the United States being in Afghanistan? As I say, the Post reports on this, a two-page diplomatic note giving U.S. forces virtual carte blanche to conduct operations as they see fit. President Bush pledged in a 2005 declaration with Afghan President Karzai to develop appropriate arrangements and agreements, formally spelling out the terms of the U.S. troop presence. No such agreements have ever been drawn up. After a U.S.-led airstrike last week that killed the Afghans, say 90 civilians, the U.S. says 5, they agree on civilians. Karzai publicly called for a review of all foreign forces in Afghanistan and a formal status of forces agreement. He's acting like Maliki. The prospect of codifying the ad hoc rules in Afghanistan sends shudders through the Bush administration, says the Washington Post, which has struggled, of course, with Baghdad. It's never been done because the issues have been too big to surmount, says one U.S. official who was not authorized to discuss the subject on the record. The most diplomatic way of saying it is that there are just a lot of moving parts, unquote. He says the Afghan government is not the most streamlined and efficient system, so you'd have a multiplicity of players on that side. Less diplomatic U.S. officials frequently describe elements of Karzai's government as deeply corrupt and incompetent. He'd be welcome in Alaska. Although most civilian war deaths in Afghanistan are caused by Taliban forces, those resulting from the highly visible airstrikes are a particular cause of public outrage. And there are some moving parts on our side, too, I'm betting. You know, military and non-military. Wink, wink. Get what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm talking about. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, that big ugly thing is in the Gulf of Mexico. Also the hurricane moving towards somewhere in southern Louisiana. Moving, in fact, at the time this broadcast is originating, towards the area of coastal wetlands that are disappearing in Louisiana at the rate of a football field every 45 minutes. So get that hurricane in quick before we lose any more football fields. The coastal wetlands, of course, are the buffer. They're the land that the hurricane travels over before getting to New Orleans. So the less land the hurricane travels over, the more water, the more intense it is when it gets to New Orleans. Thanks very much, everybody who's helped destroy the coastal wetlands. And Mayor Nagin, yeah, I know. Mayor Nagin described Gustav on Saturday as the mother of all storms and urged all New Orleanians to evacuate in advance of a mandatory evacuation. I talked to some friends of mine in New Orleans. I'm in the home of the homeless, but I talked to some friends of mine in New Orleans. A couple of them are determined to stay. One of them says he's 60-40 in favor of staying right now. And you might wonder why they give such little credence to the scary words voiced by Mayor Ray Nagin. He is, of course, returned to the national scene with these recent statements, but New Orleanians' most recent acquaintanceship with Ray Nagin, because he doesn't visit town all that often, was a week ago Friday when there was a ritzy event at the Ritz-Carlton, hence the adjective, organized by, well, it was tough to find out originally. I got an invitation to this event myself, an evening honoring the heroes of the recovery. And that was how the invite was sent out when people accepted and people agreed to be presenters. And then it turns out the main recipient of a Hero of the Recovery Award was Mayor Ray Nagin. And then it turns out the organizer of the event is his personal photographer, Bernardo. Hello, welcome to the show.
Well, we all have those terrible days when you can't even make it out your own front door, and life seems to get in your way. And is it any wonder that sometimes it's easier to hide under the covers? So when somebody calls you and they say they understand, it's like a hand across the water, a hand across the water. A sister, brother, father, mother, you are all. And you turn me around. We all have those terrible times when you want something so bad your insides ache. And you try to eat your breakfast, but there's tears on the flakes. And is it any wonder that sometimes it's easier to cry than to recover? Somebody calls you and they say you're not alone. It's like a hand across the water, a hand across the water. And sister, brother, father, mother, you are all. And you turn me around. You turn around. You know that I like it.
those terrible days when you try to be strong but you're shaking inside. You try to be a grown-up but you feel more like a motherless child, darling. Is it any wonder when somebody calls you and they say they understand? It's like a hand across the water, a hand across the water. And sister, brother, father, mother, you are all. And you turn me around. You know you turn me around. You turn me around. Turn me around.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. As I say, friends of mine are staying in New Orleans, so this program is going to be kind of a virtual hurricane party. Yeah, we'll be focusing on the nutty stuff that's going on in the world, trying to have a good time, the way people do when they stay for hurricanes. Ladies and gentlemen, Belgian authorities have warned people in the south of the country not to eat locally grown produce after a leak from a nuclear research institute. Well, those have to be safe. They're research. A safety alert was issued after a leak of radioactive iodine gas from a laboratory in Fleurus, near the southern city of Charleroi. Charles the King to you. Locals have been told not to eat locally grown fruit, vegetables, or dairy products as a precaution. The Belgian Nuclear Control Agency has described the leak as serious. That's interesting that an agency would do that. Also, a federal jury this week convicted a former nuclear plant engineer here in the United States, as a matter of fact in Ohio, of hiding information from regulators about the worst corrosion ever found at a nuclear reactor in the United States. That can't be serious. By the way, the Belgian regulators were initially criticized for playing down the incident, but now they're serious. But now here's this federal jury convicting a former nuclear plant engineer. Prosecutors said the engineer Andrew Simazko and two other workers lied in 2001 so that the Davis-Bessie plant along Lake Erie, nobody gets their drinking water from that, could delay a shutdown for a safety inspection. Months later, inspectors did find an acid leak in the reactor's 6-inch thick steel cap. Simazko covered up the damage and lied to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The jury said he faces up to 5 years in prison and $250,000 in fines. His lawyers said the plant's owner set him up as a scapegoat because he had spoken out about safety concerns. After the acid leak was discovered, the regulatory agency increased inspections and training, and began requiring detailed records of its discussions with plant operators. Never too late, department, because it's clean, safe, and too cheap to meter. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm. And yes, we have the music. What's your problem, Denver?
Soft, listen to the warm.
I'll tell you who the problem is.
Listen to the warm.
Listen to the credits of last week's show. Ladies and gentlemen, the swift, which is traditionally the last migratory bird to arrive in Ireland for the breeding season and to first leave, is still being seen along the south coast. According to Birdwatch Ireland, the swift, which is often mistaken for a large swallow, hey, watch it, we're talking about birds, should have departed for warmer climes much earlier in August. Bird migratory patterns are useful to look at when seeking evidence of climate change, and we may be looking at that, said the spokesperson for Birdwatch Ireland. When we see blackbirds nesting in February, we have to think about what's going on. He said, what's going on? I'm Arvin Gadim. Arctic sea ice has shrunk to the second lowest level since record-keeping began 3 decades ago. A group of international researchers announced this week a revolution underscoring how rapidly climate change is transforming ecosystems in northern latitudes. The extent of Arctic sea ice is 2 million square kilometers below the long-term average for August 26th. The National Snow and Ice Data Center announces that it has reached the same conclusion. If we continue to lose ice at this rate, we will beat the 2007 record, said a research scientist, Julian Strove. We're going to lose that ice.
You're going to lose that.
No, you're going to lose that ice, so we've got to understand what this means for the rest of us. The ice over the one of the seas in the area is already showing patches of open water within the ice. Much of the Beaufort Sea north of Alaska is open. I guess that's how Sarah Palin will get here. The shrinking sea ice is increasing the pressure on polar bears in the region. We know that. Although a group of oil and other industry companies. What the heck is he saying? You know what I'm saying? Is suing the federal government over regulations designed to protect the polar bear because it might be contrary to their company's interests. Dateline Washington, McClatchy newspapers report this. Scientists call it the Great Dying. An estimated 95% of all marine species and up to 85% of land creatures perished. Life took millions of years to recover. Scientific sleuths now think they're making progress toward pinning down what caused the extinction of most plants and animals on Earth some 251 million years ago. The perpetrator wasn't an asteroid or comet. Instead, it was a cascade of events that began with a monstrous outpouring of hot, reeking lava. Woo! In Siberia, repeated floods of lava released massive amounts of carbon dioxide, which produced a runaway greenhouse effect, oxygen-starved oceans, and a poisoned atmosphere. The slaughter is formally known as the Permian-Triassic mass extinction because it marked the end of the Permian geologic period and the beginning of the Triassic. The National Science Foundation has launched an international project to study the Siberian lava. The extinction is a cautionary tale for our time. The end Permian catastrophe is an extreme version of the consequences of global warming, says Lee Kump, a geoscientist at Penn State. This reminds us that there are unexpected consequences of CO2 buildup, and these can be quite dire indeed. The lessons of the massacre are directly applicable to the present, says John Isbell, a geoscientist at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, says the world today is in danger of exceeding a CO2 threshold that could set off an environmental upheaval as great as the one 251 million years ago. Exactly what caused the ancient mass extinction is still unclear. Don't know why the lava started flowing all of a sudden. And the team for the Institute of Cetacean Research in Tokyo measured the bodies of more than 4,500 minke whales killed since the late 1980s when Japan started its controversial whaling program. They found the whales are getting thinner at an alarming rate. Evidence suggests global warming could be to blame because it's restricting food supplies. Japanese researchers can't get the findings published in a couple of scientific journals because of the unpopularity of the whaling program among scientists. And finally, News of the Warm, the award-winning News of the Warm, I don't mention that nearly often enough. Heated car seats, this is news of a different warm. Heated car seats may keep your hind end nice and toasty, but beware if you're male. They could also be doing damage to your reproductive equipment. According to New Scientist, optimal sperm production requires a temperature 1 to 2 degrees centigrade below the core body temperature. This is one reason for male anatomy. To test whether heated car seats might be raising scrotal temperatures above this threshold, a researcher at the University of Giessen in Germany and his colleagues fitted temperature sensors to 30 healthy men who then sat on a heated car seat for 90 minutes. An hour in, scrotal temperature had already risen to an average of 37.3 degrees centigrade. That's above normal core body temperature, a maximum in one man of 39. That's a slight increase due to the heated seats. The researcher notes it may nevertheless be enough to damage the sperm production process. Previous research suggests that couples take longer to conceive if the man drives a car for more than 3 hours a day. If he drives for more than 4 hours, of course, seek immediate medical attention. News of the Worm, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. So, ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned before the regard in which Mayor Ray Nagin is held. He issued this piece of advice this week in the ramp up to the possible landfall, the probable landfall of Gustav. Quote, look out for your friends and family members who may seem a little withdrawn. The key signs to look out for in people who are withdrawn are they can't seem to complete tasks, unquote. So the mayor has now delivered a self-diagnosis. The most notable task that we've learned recently he's unable to complete is was taken on by an organization oddly called NOAA, the New Orleans Affordable Housing Agency, which had the job of cleaning and gutting the houses of people who are too old or too poor to be able to otherwise clean and gut their homes damaged in the flood 3 years ago. And about 3 weeks ago, local TV station began broadcasting the result of its investigation. Apparently, a lot of the homes that the, and this was funded by federal dollars, a lot of the homes that the agency billed the feds for cleaning and gutting were never cleaned and gutted, and many of them, in any case, were later demolished as blighted. Then, after the mayor attacked the TV station for hurting the recovery, it turns out that either the leading or the second leading recipient of money from the agency for cleaning and gutting homes that were not cleaned and gutted was the mayor's brother-in-law. When informed of this at a press conference, the mayor said he was surprised and he's going to look into it. That is so wrong.
I just needed a deal, brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law.
My bid had built an appeal,
brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. The mayor was my pal. His sister was my gal. So lay off the grand mal, brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law.
Gutting houses is hard,
brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. So we mainly hung in the yard,
brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. The dollars came from the feds. Of course we used our heads. At least we got out of our beds, brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. Brother-in-law.
Now they've opened some probes,
brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. With TV lights and strobes,
brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. I feel like I'm under a hex. I barely cash the checks. So give my best regards to my ex, brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law. Brother-in-law.
Hello,
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, this half hour will be error-free. It's time for me to read the trades for you, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. From LegalTimes.com, from the Influence blog, look who's lobbying for Pakistan. I'll read it for you. Punchline comes pretty early. Like now, former White House Chief Counsel Harriet Myers is now a lobbyist for the Embassy of Pakistan and the Pakistan People's Party. It's like a hurricane party, only less virtual. On her foreign agent registration short form for Lock Lord Strategies, the former Supreme Court nominee cites her work as part and parcel of Lock Lord's effort to, quote, promote better understanding of Pakistan's recent political, social, and economic developments, and line up state visits to Washington. Neither Myers nor her colleagues could be reached for comment. The firm was retained in March to promote democracy and pressure Pakistan's government to investigate Benazir Bhutto's assassination. While the agency began with only her widower, Asif Ali Zardari, and the People's Party as a client, it quickly moved on to representing the nation as a whole. The embassy is paying $900,000 for a year of the services of Harriet Myers. You know, Supreme Court Justice, lobbyist for Pakistan. It's all a flip of the coin. And in other trades, from Information Week, Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Brunner this week filed countercharges against Premier Election Solutions. Any idea who that is? Premier Election Solutions, formerly Diebold, claiming the company, in her countersuit, failed to live up to its contractual obligations by providing electronic voting machines that malfunctioned and lost votes. Didn't just do one or the other. It's a twofer. Brunner filed the lawsuit in response to one that Premier Election Services, formerly Diebold, brought against Cuyahoga County Board of Elections and the Secretary of State, requesting a court determination stating it had met its contractual obligations. We've taken this action to recover taxpayer funds spent for voting systems used in half of the state's 88 counties because Ohioans deserve better, Brunner said in an announcement. Ohio seeks punitive damages for providing touchscreen voting machines that caused problems in at least 11 of 44 counties using them. It claims breach of warranty, breach of contract, failure to conform to Ohio law, and fraud in inducement. Brunner said Premier's, formerly Diebold's, system dropped votes when memory cards were uploaded to shared servers. Election staff did recover the votes hours later, she said. Election workers notified Premier of the problems and received a product advisory notice in late May, explaining that an antivirus program that operated on the server had caused the problems. Premier instructed users to disable the antivirus software on vote tabulation servers when uploading votes from memory cards. Paper and pencil, anybody? Come on. Then on May 30th, Premier, formerly Diebold, sued the Ohio Secretary of State and requested the court to state it had complied with all of its obligations under its contracts and warranties. Brunner continues to investigate the malfunctions and test Premier, formerly Diebold's, explanation that the problem was caused by the antivirus software. The state is developing mitigation plans to fix the problem. Well, if the government's fixing the problem, then who's the problem? It's a tangled web, isn't it? You realize that when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, on the subject of the digital television transition, a listener writes in this morning to say, yeah, I saw that television press conference where Ray Nagin told people in New Orleans to get out. He said, what happens after the digital changeover for the people too poor to afford the converter boxes? Another listener wrote in this week to say that he lives in a loft building. He applied for the federal coupon to subsidize the converter box and was told he's ineligible because his loft building is in a area of his city zoned for business, and the coupon offer applies only to areas of cities that are residentially zoned. Thank you. Good night. Now, this from, well, this actually could have been a trade. I stopped the music too soon. But anyway, from Television Broadcast Publications, an August 27th status report from the FCC indicates only 56% of the nation's TV stations are completely prepared to shut off their analog transmitters. Out of 1,790 active TV stations, they don't look so active, too. A total of 1,002 have reported that they are ready for the transition. Of those that have more to do, the agency said 736 haven't completed digital build-outs, i.e. putting up their transmitter and getting the equipment, but report making appropriate progress. A total of 56 have taken up the FCC and its offer of flexibility regarding unique technical challenges. At least one unidentified station said it would have to go dark for a few days after February 17th in order to power up its digital operation. Three others haven't sent in their forms. The FCC recently also identified 80 television markets that are most at risk of chaos in the digital transition because of their high concentration of over-the-air reliance. These include all those communities in which more than 100,000 households, or at least 15% of the households, rely solely on over-the-air signals for television. The FCC commissioners will fan out to these communities to raise awareness. Uh-oh. Look out. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. No relation to the previous, of course.
We're so sorry.
Dateline San Francisco. This is an apology not yet delivered, but Citibank agreed this week to repay $14 million taken from 53,000 customer credit accounts, plus interest and penalties, after a three-year investigation by the California Attorney General's Office revealed the bank's policy of clearing positive balances off customer credit accounts. The Attorney General's Office quotes a bank executive saying, quote, "Stealing from our customers is a business decision." The company knowingly stole from its customers, and mostly poor people and the recently deceased, says California Attorney General Jerry Brown. And a spokesperson from his office says the poor and the dead tend to be less financially organized. So we'll wait for Citibank's apology. Meanwhile, Dateline New York, a man convicted of secretly cutting up corpses, including that of Masterpiece Theater host Alastair Cook, has received a sentence of 9 to 27 years in prison for his role in a multi-million-dollar body parts scheme. Christopher Aldorassi was convicted of 20 counts. Prosecutors said he and others took bone and tissue without family permission and sold the pieces to medical companies for use in transplants and other medical procedures. He could have faced up to 60 years in prison. The scheme's ringleader, Michael Mastromarino, publicly apologized for his crimes last week. He faces a maximum of 54. Denver Mayor John Hickenlooper, I actually met him this past week, apologized to a well-to-do donor. The unnamed man had to wait out in line for about 2 hours under the hot sun Thursday afternoon before entering Invesco Field to watch Barack Obama's speech. "You can imagine that when you're worth a couple of $100 million, you don't spend much time waiting in line," said Hickenlooper, who would say only that the man owns a company in New York. Trump! "He's cool," Hickenlooper said after speaking to the man. "He understands things like this happen." "It was my fault," Hickenlooper said when a member of his staff started to apologize to her, to him. He told her not to apologize. "The buck stops with me," Hickenlooper said. President of Hungary, Laszlo Szolyom, expressed his deep regret over Hungary's role in the occupation of Czechoslovakia in 1968, speaking outside the House of Terror Museum. On the 40th anniversary of the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, Szolyom said, "Although the intervention was implemented by sheer force rather than the will of the people, that does not exonerate Hungarians from responsibility. We have something to be ashamed of," he declared. "Hungary's political regime put the country in the position of attacking another nation that wanted more freedom. Making an apology," he said, "can remove a thorn." Nicholas Kristof, columnist in the New York Times, is apologizing to Stephen Hatfill, a man whom he fingered as a suspect in the anthrax letters case. Neil Diamond has apologized to his fans. No, not for that. He's offering audiences at a recent Ohio concert a refund and asking for their forgiveness after he performed with a raspy voice earlier this week. He issued a statement on his website apologizing to fans in Columbus. "Until you hear from me again," he says, "remember, you are the sun, I am the moon, you are the words, I am the tune. Forgive me, I love you." Unquote. President Fernando Lugo of Paraguay has apologized on behalf of the nation to victims of the 1954-1989 dictatorship of the late General Alfredo Stroessner, supported by the CIA. Speaking this week at the country's Truth and Justice Commission, Lugo asked for forgiveness from the victims for abuses under what he called the worst dictatorship, which must never return again to Paraguay. The commission presented documents containing the names of 300 politicians, opposition leaders, students, and union leaders who were tortured after being arrested by Stroessner security forces and whose remains were never found. It's not really torture if... Author Salman Rushdie reportedly has won an apology in London High Court from a former bodyguard who made false claims against him. And the Snohomish County Washington Republican Party apologized this week after the organization's booth at the Evergreen State Fair sold $3 bills depicting Barack Obama wearing Arab headgear and featuring a camel. I think the bill was featuring a camel. I don't think Barack Obama was. And finally, Dateline Montreal, the president of a popular Quebec clothing chain, has apologized for the use of rail-thin models in a store back-to-school fashion catalog. Peter Simons said he had failed to exercise proper attention, empathy, and especially sensitivity and social responsibility there to the thing. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, an oh-so-copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Heaven, please send to all mankind understanding and peace of mind. And if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love, someone to love. Show the world how to get along. Peace will enter when all hate is gone. And if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love, someone to love. I lie awake nights and ponder a world of trouble, and my answer is always the same, that unless man can put an end to this damnable sin, hate will put the world in a flame. What a shame. Just because I'm in misery, I don't beg for no sympathy. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love, someone to love. We'll be right back. not unless man can put an end to this damnable sin. Hate will put the world in a flame. What a shame. Just because I'm in misery. You know, I don't beg for no, I don't beg for no sympathy. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to run, someone to love. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Won't you please send me someone to love?
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Up to Here. Up to Here, a daily once over, not so lightly, on the story at the top of what's behind today's news. I'm CPR special correspondent Aviva Schlorman, sitting in for Allegro Del Fuego, who's on assignment. For people who like politics, this has been a week to savor. For people who don't like politics, this has been a week to savor Mama Schlorman's peach cobbler, if you got the recipe from our website. But back to politics. The last 72 hours have provided two intensely dramatic stories. Barack Obama's acceptance speech in front of 80,000 supporters in Denver, followed shortly by John McCain's choice of Sarah Palin as his running mate. But the pace of news didn't take Labor Day weekend off, unlike Allegra Del Fuego. CPR political editor Jonathan Zizix brings you up to date, up to here. Jonathan?
Aviva, when Barack Obama decided not to put Hillary Clinton on his ticket, some political observers believe a large group of women was put in play, politically speaking. Those observers say that may have been the key reason for the surprise choice of an obscure first-term Alaska governor, who happens to be female, as John McCain's running mate. Those same observers, clearly getting fatigued with the need for constant observing, wondered what the Obama campaign's response might be. As of 8 a.m. this morning, the wondering was at an end.
At approximately 6:47 yesterday evening, Senator Joseph Biden entered Christ the Enhancer Hospital in Philadelphia for a long-planned elective surgery procedure. 2 hours and 21 minutes later, the procedure was completed, and Senator Joseph Biden emerged from the operating theater as Senator Darlene Biden. Both Mrs. Biden and her wife, Jill Biden, are reported to be resting comfortably, although initial reports indicate that Jill Biden is the more comfortable of the two.
That Blockbuster announcement, delivered ironically just outside a downtown Philadelphia Blockbuster store, sent shockwaves rippling far beyond Senator Biden's endocrine system. Within the half hour, Senator John McCain interrupted the rehearsal of his acceptance speech to talk briefly to reporters.
At first, I want to extend my hand, and not literally, to my colleague Senator Biden and express my hope for a full recovery. Well, not a full one, but I guess by definition that's impossible. But I do want to say that this does appear to be a despicable political stunt pulled off by an increasingly desperate Democrat political operation, and I'm not referring to the operation. I hope that wasn't desperate. Let's all hope it was calm and careful and so forth. But I think that the American people, especially women, are smart enough to recognize the difference between somebody who was born a woman and someone who has to, in their sixth decade, start sitting when standing used to be fine. Let me just say, my running mate started out her career as a runner-up in the Miss Alaska competition. I think her current opponent wouldn't have made it past the first night of the Miss... What the heck is that contest? Thank you, fellas.
Minutes later, Biden spokeswoman Kendra Smiley shot back in a conference call with the media.
I think Senator McCain's regrettable outburst earlier today was a tasteless and uncalled-for attack on the hundreds of thousands of transgender Americans. I think the issue of whether or not Senator Biden had, in fact, planned this exact surgery for the last little while can't be allowed to obscure the fact that the senator was willing to heed this particular call. We think women as well as men will respond to his obvious willingness to sacrifice as well as to help make history as the first transgender vice presidential nominee. If the Republicans choose to stand in the way of that history, that's something they'll have to answer to history for.
Clearly the knives are out, metaphorically speaking as well. CPR spoke exclusively with analyst David Gergen on his car phone as he traveled to a Sunday morning talk show appearance.
If John McCain choosing Sarah Palin was a roll of the dice, then this was a roll of something far more personal. How will voters perceive it? I think that depends more than anything else on how Senator Biden frames it once she's able to return to public appearances. If she retains her unpredictable, say, whatever comes into her head, personality from her days as a gentleman, and if she's at least halfway presentable, I think that there may be what you might call a new woman bounce. On the other hand, there is a certain unpredictable, what we used to call in politics, a yick factor that may not show up in the polls. But I understand from sources in the Biden campaign that he's got a computer in his room. He's already preparing remarks for his return to the campaign trail, as well as doing some online shopping for shoes. But one thing's for certain, we're going to see a ratings record for vice presidential debates when these two go mano a mano. Both sets of hands, of course, will be manicured. That's all I got.
CPR's David Gergen. Senator Obama himself has had no comment so far on his running mate's change of gender, but a spokesperson for the campaign said, quote, Joe Biden's wealth of foreign policy experience will now be at Darlene Biden's fingertips. That's what counts, unquote. Everyone appears to agree this was an unprecedented move in American politics, but masterstroke or costly fumble? We'll know November 4th for sure. I'm Jonathan Zizek in Washington.
And up to now, you're up to here. We had help tonight from CPR's Just in Time Fund for coverage of stories we just can't record well in advance, and from the John and Dora Yerkel Foundation, something John did for Dora before she left him. I'm CPR's special correspondent, Aviva Schlorman. Join us next time we get you up to speed, up to here. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio. Woo!
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the position, those of us in or of New Orleans, where we're hoping, among other things, that the Corps of Engineers aren't the screw-ups we believe them to be. Ironic, isn't it? That concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM satellite radio. Yes, they've merged. You got a problem with that? Around the world via the internet at two different locations on your computer, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/theshow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like Louisiana dodging another bullet if you'd agree to be with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Hawaii desks. Playlists for this broadcast and the email address for the host of this program are available all the time at worldfamousharryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.